My name is Julian Chambliss. It is April 18th, 2023. I'm on a Zoom call with Nate Talbot, who is here representing and telling me about his work on blockchain in Detroit. Nate, can you say and spell your name for me?
Yeah, my name's Nate Talbot. Spell it Nate, NATE Talbot, TALBOT.
Right. Do I have permission to record you for Voices of the Black Imaginary Oral History Archive?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I've been looking at some of your materials and some of the stuff that you said, and I think it's always important in a situation like this to ask people about their educational background and their career. How did you get to the place that you are now? So can you tell me a little bit about your sort of educational journey and professional journey that got you to the place where you started doing what you're doing right now?
I actually have a sort of a varied background. I think part of it is important to go all the way back a little further back than probably what you want, which is around third or fourth grade when I got my first computer in the 80s, and was fiddling around with that, which sparked a lot of my technological inquiries, right? And then I can fast forward back. I landed in Detroit. I had a scholarship to go to University of Detroit Mercy. I studied communications there. My real interest, though, at that point was entertainment. Right, I was into the music scene. I was working on becoming a producer. I wanted to learn how to engineer. As most people do, I got a lot of hands-on training more than in-school training, and that led me a few years later in early two in 99. Oh no, 90. Yeah, 99. I met a long-term business partner. He was a popular producer in the area, an engineer. He had showed me some tips and tricks in the late 90s. I sort of got my path going, and we decided to partner. He was starting his own multimedia company and was looking for a partner, so we partnered up. And that's really what started my journey down this path here. Computers were just starting to become really popular. The web was just starting to become popular in, 99, 2000. We started off with just sort of doing graphic design and some music production work. That turned into doing marketing. We ended up having a TV show that started local but ended up being syndicated nationally, called Switch Play TV. So a lot of the entertainment realm things were happening. New technologies were emerging at the time, right? So you had the birth of like MP3 video streaming. We're still pre-YouTube era. MySpace wasn't even a thing yet at that point. So I'm really getting into what the new technology is. We're starting to work on website design stuff. And then on a business end, and this is sort of how it gets me here, is a lot of the artists we worked with found moderate success and were looking for other things to do. I was always sort of more into the books than anything else. My mom was a paralegal. She had Black's Law Dictionary, and I would pick that up and browse through that for fun sometimes. So when we wanted to start doing business encounters and start their own businesses operations, they would come to me. I sort of turned converted into a consultant. And I worked between those artists and their sort of professional partners, like lawyers and accountants, to sort of get the job done for them and help them articulate what they're looking for. And I did that for some years. So that brings us to around 2016-ish. Well, I guess 2014, when I first discovered Bitcoin. This got me in the blockchain space. Like most people, I came more for the speculation aspects, right? I tell people all the time, sort of come for the riches. But I stayed for the revolution. And that's really what got me here. A few companies We're also interested in getting into blockchain around 2017. I already had the consulting, so they hired us to sort of come in and see how they could utilize it. And it was a very failed business venture for me. I had probably about 6 major clients, and I talked all of them out of it. And that's mostly because they wanted like a QuickBooks type edition, like the new tech. I just want to apply new tech. I saw bigger things, more revolutionary things for it, and I didn't want them to use it. It failed, and then they say things like, well, this was just a waste. If you're going to use it, like you should use it the right way, like any tool. So that's sort of what got me from beginning there, a path of, you know, entertainment, consulting into blockchain with technology always sort of floating in the background for me.
I really appreciate that. I want to sort of do a little deeper dive into some of the things you talked about there, because you mentioned starting out in entertainment, which is not shocking. I think, you know, there's a lot of technical things, especially in music. It's an important historical thing where like technical things are important. So, but you also talked about like you did more on the job training versus book training. So what would you say was your sort of technical acumen as you were working through this? Was it more focused on finance? Was it like sound technology? Where were computer, what's your sort of computer culture interactions in that in your journey? Was it high, low, medium?
Probably in the medium range. You know, when I was younger, back in third, fourth grade, you know, I had a computer, I had a Commodore 64, playing around in that, and that sort of got me into early programming. I'm by no means a computer programmer. But you know, it would learn, taught me how to work around code. I would write databases. I wrote a couple programs from the back of PC magazine and things. As I got into music when I was around 16 or so, I fell away from the technology side because I was more focused on the music. And it wasn't until college I really got back on a computer and the whole interface was different. I'm used to having to go to a computer and, you know, actually enter code to make it start, like load this, run actual command line programming for everything. And now there's this mouse and this interface and you just click things. It was an experience. And it sort of actually threw me back for a moment. But as I was getting into the music, things were going from analog to 2-track tape recorders to DATs, digital audio tapes, and computerized programming. So I had to get back into computers and sort of face that. But then the internet was also becoming a bigger thing. So I was able to use that as a resource. And that sort of merged me back into that world. And like, I guess always I've sort of just been on that frontier edge. That's what catches my interest, right? So there's the new things. I could have stayed with analog and traditional ways for a few more years, but I wanted to push the new technology because you could do so many cool things and it was so much cheaper. Okay. You know, so they had some economic advantages. And then another thing that happened, we started doing the web design stuff. We hired an in-house web designer. A guy came in from New York looking for some work, and he was like, this is when, if you remember Flash, when all the websites were like animated cartoony, he was big on that, and he really started to kick my interest back up too. He sort of forced my hand to get back into it. So that's really how the technological part came back for me, and then seeing what the web could do. Again, doing entertainment, and then the consulting side, it was like, no, you have to sort of think about what it is you're selling, what it is you're doing. And you can keep trying to do traditional marketing, but you're not going to compete, right? You need to find the new cutting edge ways. And that's sort of what that was for me.
Okay. I think one of the things that seems really key to your journey is this sort of intersection between creativity and technology. And I think one of the the thing that kind of defines Afrofuturism is a kind of intersection between creativity and technology. And so I wonder, do you see yourself sort of as an Afrofuturist? Like, how do you situate the work, the work that you're doing or your approach? Do you have a philosophical lens that defines it? Is it Afrofuturism or is it something else?
No, not at that point. I was just young and sort of doing what interested me. I'm sort of relatively new to the even concept of Afrofuturism within the past 4 or 5 years when it started to come on my radar. I was, through that journey, I was also, as a young man, starting to open up more to worldly issues. So there was a lot of, I started researching, as a 20, 21 year old, researching Kemet, Egyptian history, world history, archaeological things, just where we came from, where the perspective of the world came from, and especially in the viewport of an African American, where that fits in, where that identity fits in and whatnot, which is, still part of that. Again, with it came to Bitcoin, I say you come for the riches, stay for the revolution. That's part of the revolution for me. The technology is unlocking a lot of historically walled gardens. We're now able to sort of bypass using technology in a way that it just wasn't possible before. So I try to grasp onto that. And to me, that does tie in as I learn more about Afrofuturism, that ties into those concepts. So I definitely see the connection. I do wish then I was more alert about it. Sometimes when you know what it is you're doing, it drives you even more.
Sure.
Stumbling upon it works just as well, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's not uncommon. I think, people are doing something and they get told, hey, you're an Afrofuturist. At some level, that happened to me. What? But it's interesting because, you talk about blockchain was the gateway drug. That's a horrible terminology. But the thing is sort of kind of got you in. But arguably, the work you're doing isn't simply about Bitcoin. It's about a bigger, as you say, technological intervention that's around a series of, as you describe them, walled gardens. So can you talk a little bit about your sort of evolution around thinking about Bitcoin and how that sort of led to your contemporary practice with advocating for blockchain? Because the other thing is I think most people who might be listening to this in, we're doing this in 2023, and I kid you not, most people, if you say blockchain, they think Bitcoin, but I'm like, that's not actually true. Bitcoin's this over here. Blockchain's a more broader technological toolkit in a way. At least that's how I think of it. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But, I think, at some level that there's an important sort of definitional ambiguity for the public. I'd be interested for you to sort of talk about, I started with blockchain. I mean, I started with Bitcoin, an interest in Bitcoin, and that led me through to where I am doing what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. Bitcoin was the first application to utilize a blockchain. A blockchain, it's this mystical word. It's really just a distributed database, right? There's nothing very special about a blockchain. It's really more about the several factors built around that. And so for Bitcoin, for me, that transition, like I said, for most people, it was the financial part. This is a new asset class being born, similar to, so you can think of it similar to the gold rush, any of the many several gold rushes throughout history, where there is, for a period of time, there will be a way for people to build generational wealth from this. In a way, again, that's permissionless, which is the really intriguing part about it. Even with a gold rush or any other asset class, you need permission to access it, right? If you want to go out west and look for gold in the 1800s, you still need permission from landowners or the government to travel across the land, dig in the land, and do all this. If you have access to some kind of internet, is the most popular, but it's not exclusively internet. But if you have access to a communication protocol, you can acquire Bitcoin. So there's that permissionless gap there. Bitcoin in general, and this is really what brought me over into like a Detroit Blockchain Center realm, it's money. It's a form of money, but it's more than just this technology. It is a network. Uppercase Bitcoin is, it's not the blockchain that makes it strong. There's a lot of projects that use blockchain, and a lot of them are really not worth even thinking about. A lot of people think about Bitcoin because it has this digital scarcity into it. There'll only ever be 21 million Bitcoin that can be mined, but there's a lot of things you can make arbitrary scarcity if that isn't what drives value. When it comes to things like money, money is a construct, right? Humans invented money as a way to deliver, settle debt between each other. So all we have to do is really agree on set of rules, and anything can be money. The problem is those rules always change, and it's always the people who have no seat at the table who get the worst end of the deal on that change. And that becomes the big, big issue. And that's what Bitcoin is really set to, the problem it's set to solve. It came out in 2000, the actual protocol launched in 2009. The white paper came out in 2008. And that was really what the whole purpose was. We just got through the 2008 recession with all of the foolery that happened with the banks and the housing crisis. And, you know, it caused a global recession. And it was all because a few people decided to play by their own set of rules with zero transparency, right? So the people who were affected most by it were people who didn't even know it was happening until it was already done. And then the people who got bailed out the most are the same people who caused the problem in the first place. And so how do you fix that? And you have to, one thing is things have to be more transparent, right? You have to be able to see what the, if we're all playing by this arbitrary set of rules, we all got to know what the rules are and that everybody's following them in a transparent way. Trusting institutions alone doesn't really do it anymore. And you don't need to do it anymore. And I'm not anti-institutionalist, but sometimes institutions were invented because, or created because, there was no other way. If you and me wanted to transact in a way, I don't know you and you don't know me. We don't have this trust. We needed a trusted third party. Now, because of technology, you don't need a trusted third party, right? We use math as the trusted third party. That's why it's a cryptocurrency. It's based on cryptography, which is just complex math for secure messaging, right? So we remove a trusted third party, and that allows you and me to interact directly without having to trust a third party in a way that's transparent. We can see what's happening. And that makes for more, just a more frictionless environment when it comes to transacting. Bitcoin, and this is where I struggled for with Bitcoin, we're talking about money, like hard asset money, your base layer money. For that to be good, because we're still talking about technology, I have the belief that you don't want to dilute that with a lot of extra stuff. If you know anything about technology, the more complex you make it, the more vulnerable it becomes to exploits, bugs, human error. So you want that to be simple, especially when you're talking about preserving people's wealth. However, you can take that same implementation and use it for other transactional things. One of the most direct ways you could see, or one of the most relevant ways you can see, is identity, right? There's a huge global identity problem. I woke up one morning in 2018, I want to say, maybe it was 2019. Scrolled through my phone, was just looking at some news stories, and I saw this story from India, and there was this little tribe in northern India that they were refugees from another neighboring country. They didn't really have any place to go. India opened their doors to them and let them stay there. They never gave them citizenship. They're like, you can have this little land and just stay here. You're not citizens, but you got a place to go. And they were there for generations, you know, decades at least. And one morning, like, look at that, flipped over. India just decided on a whim, like, yeah, never mind. We want you to leave. Get out. But it's like, now these people have been here for decades. They don't have identity. Where do they go? If you ever tried to travel international, they ask you for identity. Well, if you don't have a sovereign state verifying your identity, as far as the globe is concerned, right, you just don't exist. And so when you start thinking about what identity is in that sort of lens, what does that mean that a government or a state or any external entity tells you you don't exist? Like, I'm here. I feel like I exist, right? So what if you had a way to have like a decentralized social identity, like we have a decentralized money, right? Where you have this proof of validation, where you can, your interactions, your day-to-day interactions, which can be recorded in a transparent, trustless, permissionless way, similar to the money situation, to build up an identity. And then who says you can only have one identity? Right. I mean, if you want to open it, people have this weird, because of how it's set up, this weird vision of what identity is. Are you your birth certificate? Are you your name? Or is your name just identify an aspect of you? If you're on social media, maybe you go off of a different name. Does that make you not you? Right. Or are you bigger than just one name? Are you bigger than just one driver's license? Or college credential or whatever. We're way more complex than that. So why should we be restricted to have one narrow version of identity? However, you also need to build up trust around an identity, right? People go around and your reputation is a thing. And so you can build up your reputation around these identities. And again, in a trustless, decentralized, permissionless way, so you don't have to trust a independent agency like the Department of Motor Vehicles or Secretary of State to believe who I am. I could maybe have a trustless version of identity that shows you who I am or certain aspects about me. If I want to go to a bar, they don't need to know my name and address and everything else. They don't even need to know my birthday. They just need verifiable proof that I'm over 21, if it's a bar, or over 18 for entry. So you can do this now using the same type of technology sets. And you could even use the government to verify that, just like they verify your birth certificate and verify your driver's license. They could verify something. You go to the bar, you show them a thing, a QR code. They scan it and it checks against this database maintained by the government so they can trust it. And it says, yes, over 18. Or over 21, and that's all they need to know, right? They don't need to know you're 37 or 24 or whatever. So that's like one application of it. Or you talk about just social media with that identity. You start talking about social media. We just got through several years of two sides of an aisle, you know, arguing on who's getting shadow banned on social media. Right. It's like, oh, censorship and all this and all that. And it's like, why should the problem of that isn't necessarily the problem of that is that we're trusting, again, institutions to make these determinations for us. If I start, I'm going to just pick on Facebook because everyone likes picking on Facebook. But if you go to Facebook in 2023, what are you really doing? Right. You go to their website. You You tell them an email address. That's their identifier for you, your email address. You give a password, and that's like a key to unlock access to their system where you're going to generate content, right? Name, pictures, stories, whatever. But then one day they just decide they don't like you anymore and they lock you out. Now that's fine, that's their right, but they've just locked you out of all your content, your following, the people you follow. Why should they get to control that? Imagine a world where you generate this content, this following, this network of individuals on your own. And when you go to a place like Facebook, you're not asking them permission to access your stuff. They're asking you permission to access your stuff. We would like to see your content and display it in a certain way. And at any point, you have that power to pull that back away. And this now ties into data. Everybody's big on, oh, my privacy. They're selling all my data. Well, they're selling your data because you're giving it all to them. So again, imagine a world where we flip that on its head, and this technology allows you to do all that. So that was a long answer to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that was getting at my next question, because I think, you know, when you look at the sort of mission of the Detroit Blockchain Center as a nonprofit, you know, it kind of describes itself as a resource center. And I think what you just said kind of points to your emphasis on providing education and fostering community. But also, you know, it's clear from the paperwork and the write-ups about it that you're trying to accelerate the creation of a system like the one that you're sort of alluding to, like to empower people. And in particular, there seems to be, I think, some complexity around both getting the sort of resources to create it, like investment, but also, I think, making people aware of the potentiality around what blockchain sort of represents. And so I think what you talked about there were some indications, but I think it's important for people to kind of understand the specific needs that you see central to what you're trying to address. So you mentioned like privacy, for instance, and I think you are kind of referencing questions of a kind of economic stability or security or opportunity. And I think, you know, this seems to be a really core idea for the Detroit Blockchain Center. And I think it's important for people to understand this, arguably what might be described as a liberatory impulse in what's happening here. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the need? What is the need that you're trying to bring to people, and who do you identify as the potential client? And like, is it everybody, or is there a particular sort of person you think like, yes, this is really important for you to understand, like, you know, the potential community for your efforts?
Yeah. So I think to put some things in context, you're right. This is like a liberty movement, very similar to the birth of the United States, right? In many, many ways. The whole purpose of the United States was to take power away from these very small collective, really a king, so a singular entity, and distribute it amongst the people and figure out a system. How can we manage a government on our own without being dictated to? And so you have this election system where you vote for representatives. We have this representative government and they make decisions for the people. And when they go astray, you can vote new people in. That is how a blockchain works, right? It's a decentralized network of individuals who are all agreeing to these certain rules. And you know, you can opt in or opt out of it. Right? I'm not forced to use Bitcoin. I can opt into it. I can opt out of it. I can leave the network if I want to. If I come back later on, I'm not punished for any of that. And it's all of us working together that makes this work. And in that context, when you start talking about like what are the usefulness and benefits of it, it is just that. Like one of the things I know you know we're working on with the internet and bringing community controlled internet back to people. Right now we're hooked into this cycle of just very few companies who make all these decisions that at this point is crucial, right? This is internet is a utility, it's no different than water or gas, right? You can't live in a Western society and not have access to the internet. And we learn that this isn't even theoretical anymore, right? We learned this during the lockdowns of 2020 to 2022. Schools were shut. Students had to go to school. They didn't just say, stop going to school. How did they go to school? You had to show up on Zoom. How do you get Zoom? You got to use the internet. But what about all of the millions of children that didn't have access to the internet? How do they do it? You either begged for the mercy of a large telecom company to graciously give you over access, usually at still a fee, or you sat in like a parking lot with your parents while you got on Zoom in a McDonald's or a Starbucks or something. How is that good for society? So what if we could have a world where we shifted that, where it was the communities, you had this mixture of public and private internet ownership, and we didn't depend just on a few companies, we depended more on each other to get online and to access. That shifts this power dynamic. You get incentivized to help your neighbors get access. And again, in a trustless way where you and somebody else can just interact. We don't have to trust a third party, and you don't need permission from anybody to do it. And these have been around, this concept has been around before blockchain. So, you know, they're called mesh networks and WISP, and, but they've always suffered from one crucial flaw, which was they depended on some kind of financial altruism, external financial altruism to support the network. Blockchain allows you to do this without that altruism. You can have a sustainable network. And then as we move into the future, and you hear a lot of people talk about, you know, in the Detroit area, there's a lot of talk around mobility. Around the rest of the world, they talk about smart city infrastructure. Well, you're really saying you need devices to talk to each other, right? And they can only do that using some kind of internet connection, right? And the same thing, some of the things we're working on, it's based around that. It's build smart city infrastructure, except it can be this community-owned smart city infrastructure, not this giant telecom smart city infrastructure who, at their whim, could just shut it off. Or what we've seen historically, and like this is sort of where it comes to who we address, historically, they redline areas and decide you don't get the same service as somebody else. And it doesn't have to be for any particular reason, right? They can just say, you get this kind of service, and these people over here get this kind of service. And while this technology benefits everybody, just like when the US, it theoretically benefited everybody, but it can be most impactful for those who have been historically disenfranchised and cut off from systems, all types of systems. And so that's really where we currently put our focus. We want to help communities and people who have historically been cut off from financial rails, telecommunication rails, and give them access in a way they've never had it before. And it's not, again, it's not theoretical, it's happening. And you're actually seeing the biggest growth globally in those types of communities. You're seeing it in the global South, Africa, South America. They're utilizing Bitcoin, blockchain technologies, because not only are they cut off from the financial rails, they just don't have them. You go to many countries in Africa, especially if you're not at a major city, there is no financial rail to cut you off from. They don't have a stable local economy or currency. They don't have a way to track property records. And so you're not secured in generational land like you can in more Western societies, because they don't have a way to track it, right? Who's the county clerk in a lot of these areas? It's just sort of like, I remember you sort of lived there, but now we decided you don't. Prove it, right? How do you do that without having to trust somebody? And the taking those kind of concepts and applying them even here in America, in Detroit, and allowing people, I look at the 2008 crisis, and I mean, how many people, I know several people who got eviction notices from banks where the bank didn't even have a claim on the home they had. The bank's structure was so jacked up, they didn't even know if they owned something. They just sort of threw things out and see if it sticked. Like, hey, Julian, yeah, we think your house is in foreclosure, pay us or get out. And you're like, what do you mean? I own my house, or my house is through a whole different bank. Oh, our bad. Right? That's lunacy. But again, who does that affect? Predatory lending. Who does that affect? You don't go out to the most affluent neighborhoods and see payday advance places. And they, a lot of times, are just as strung out as people in inner cities because they live off of credit, right? You have a lot of people who claim who make $250,000 or more, but live paycheck to paycheck. They're just as strung out, so they could use payday advance. Why don't you see it there? It's because they're considered more financially intelligent because they make more money, and it's harder to be predatory with them. But I can go to a neighborhood where, you know, the average income is less than $20,000 for a family. I can definitely prey on them and tell them, oh, no worries. We'll need some money. We'll give you $600 now. It's only 40% interest, right? It's ludicrous. And so we need a system that delves off of that. And again, this is what blockchain can provide. You may have heard of services like decentralized finance, which is just a way to do banking without an actual bank. Again, you could loan money, I could borrow money, and we don't need a trusted third party institution in between us.
Right. So I think what you just talked about is super important to try to understand from the perspective of a kind of transformative community practice, because a lot of what you said, one way I think I might summarize it as, let's move away from an elite few who control vital hubs of decision-making and resources, and through blockchain, create more community-based systems that support everyone. That's me simplifying a very complicated thing you just said. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge for people who are listening to you talk is about how it's operating as that decentralized system. So right before, when you just finished that, you know, I could loan money to you and you can loan money to me. We don't need a third party. And the decentralization element is both the intriguing part as a kind of like conceptual thing. No big brother. We're business on trusted relationships that are locked in kind of digital resources. But where the resources are coming from, like the let's say the resources is money. I need money. You know, on the one hand, it seems, I think people can listen to you and say like, well, he's talking about a different kind of system, but you're also at some level seemingly talking about the system itself is generating a kind of like support and resource. And I wonder, like, you know, as you're trying, another thing that the Troy Blockchain Center is doing is educating people. So I wonder at some level, how are you educating them on this, on these concepts? What are the models that you're using? Is it just simply demonstrating, like, hey, this is a here's an example of a kind of community-based blockchain thing, and let's play with this? Or is it something else that you're doing? Like, how are you making people aware of this vision that you're articulating, and how are you giving an opportunity to participate?
Right. So a large part of our education really just comes down to financial and digital literacy. Because you sort of hit it on the head. What you can't understand, if you don't know what money is, you'll never really understand how or why any of this is important. And they don't really teach you how money works. No place teaches you how money works. No institutional place teaches you how money works, right? If you go out on the street and ask the random citizen, I don't care where they're from, what is money? At best, you're going to get it's a dollar, right? They'll just point to the thing they got in their pocket. You buy stuff with it. And it's like, yeah, that's what you can do with money, but re what really is it? And we talked about that a little earlier. It's just a construct. It's a way for us, we were taught about barter trade societies, right? No historian or archaeologist has ever found evidence of any society at scale operating on barter. It's such a it's what's it called? A problem of the wants, right? They use the example, you got wood, I got milk, we trade. Well, how do we determine how much wood is equivalent for the same amount of milk? What if you don't need milk? You need bananas. It really quick, it gets really complex to show how do you take a society of 500 people, let alone 5,000 people, and make that work? It doesn't. It's always worked off of some kind of system of debt, right? Societal debt. I just know if we're small enough, we know you got wood, I got milk. If you need it, I'll give it to you because I know when I need something, I can come get it from you. When that society got big, they kept ledgers. They would keep giant stones and do markings on the stones, right? This is where arithmetic came from. When you look at early math, it came from a way of accounting debt. So that's primal in our education. We teach people what money is. We start there. Then we move into basics of like finance, which is just money is money, but finance is sort of those games you can play with money, like lending and borrowing and things like that, derivatives, stocks, all of that kind of stuff. So then we get into that kind of stuff and get people understanding just what that is. Then once they start to understand that, light bulbs start going off because they think of their own situation like, wait a minute, well, then why do I do this? It's like, yeah, exactly. Why do you do that? Why do you need to go through X, Y, and Z? What if you could just do this? Like, yeah, why can't I? It's like, you can. But it's not in, there's a lot of geopolitical reasons, I won't get into that tie into a lot of it. But at the end of the day, again, when it comes to money and transacting with people, right? So when I think of blockchain as a whole, I personally think of Bitcoin as the money piece and blockchain, these other things like Ethereum and other blockchain technologies as the finance piece. And you need them both. How can we do it without having a central bank make these determinations for you? And once you start to understand that, then you start to get why Bitcoin is important or why blockchain can be utilized. How a decentralized internet would work, right? And because it's really the only part of that, and that's blockchain, is the transaction part. How do you pay forward? How do you pay for it in a trustless way? Because you can't have, you're only as decentralized as your most centralized part, right? So we can say we're decentralized all day, but if someplace in there a core mechanism is highly centralized, well, then all of it's just that centralized. And it's important to decentralize, not because that's sort of the key thing, but that's how you keep things censorship resistant. That's how you keep things permissionless. You don't have to go through one entry point.
I think one of the things about what you're talking about that's and what you're doing that has a lot of drawn a lot of attention is that you're doing in Detroit. You know, it's a prominent Black city. It does have a long history in the context of Afrofuturism. Like, you know, it's one of these places that Steve Mirage is the determined manifestation of Afrofuturism, the Detroit techno. But I also noticed that whenever people are mentioning the work that you're doing, or they're often doing it in the context of there are communities and people in Detroit that just don't have access. And this is central to trying to provide access, trying to bridge a gap in a system that at some level is failing, or maladjusted, or not non-functional in a way, for lack of a better term, but it's a broad generalization, but it's a recurring theme. So when you think about your engagement with this work and the communities of practice that you're working with, how important is that kind of like helping the community, the kind of liberation narratives that seem, or addressing these deficits, you know, as you're advocating for this and advocating for these paths forwards, how is that question sort of driving this? Like, you know, is it particular areas that you're more active in, or are there particular groups of practice that are more responsive? You know, how is that, the things that you were talking about, they're very sophisticated and technical, meshing with the sort of like lived experience of people in Detroit?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we target people most at need, because I personally have a belief of, you know, you take those most suffering and elevate them, and it's a trickle up effect. Because if it's truly open and permissionless, then anybody can use it and utilize it. But if I lift up just those who are doing all right in the middle or higher, I'm leaving a bunch of people behind. But if I take the people who are suffering the most and lift them up, everybody benefits from that. So that's where we look at. And this one of the reasons I look at Detroit. You know, I'm a implant. I'm originally from upstate New York. You know, I've chose to come to Detroit, and one of the reasons I've stayed so long is because of its history. It is, you know, a predominantly Black city, and in my opinion, it's the Blackest city. But it also has a large scale of diversity. You know, just a few miles that'd be west of here, you have Dearborn, which has one of the highest Middle Eastern population. We have Southwest Detroit, which has an extraordinarily high Latino population. There is diversity all throughout. But, you know, Detroit has a certain culture, especially because of its history in the 40s and 60s, when you had the great flights and the riots. And that's really when the city took a downturn because of the money left, but the workers stayed, right? Mm-hmm. That generated a mindset that I haven't seen before, and I'm fairly decently traveled, at least around the U.S. It has a sort of hustler mentality that's beneficial because it just has a certain drive that people aren't used to somebody just handing them anything. So it gave that, and struggle always, you always find frontier of the arts where the struggling is the most, right? And so, like you said, like, you know, electronic music, just artists themselves, music, arts, theater. There's a lot of talent here, and that creativity is really important, because if you're going to try to find ways to teach or implement change, you got to get creative, right? You can be the greatest economist in the world or technologist in the world. If you don't have that creative edge, how do you onboard people? And if you're not onboarding people, you're really just theorizing. So I think that was really important to this. And that's sort of why we are Detroit Blockchain Center, not Michigan Blockchain Center, not the Midwest Blockchain Center. It's that culture of Detroit, that uniqueness. It's a border city. We have the biggest, busiest international commercial border, you know, in the country. You're on a main waterway. We have the Great Lake State. And these are all going to be questions that are going to need to be answered as we talk more about converting from the power from a few and distributing out to the masses. You know, you got potentially the water wars coming, right? The West Coast is running out of water. Michigan has like the largest freshwater supply maybe in the world. So outside of like the Arctic. So yeah, it's a great place to educate and first implement these kinds of decentralized systems. Because if it works here, it can work mostly everywhere else.
Okay. What's one thing you want people to know about this idea of blockchain that they don't know? Like, if there was a way that you get a particular idea into the public's mind that you think would be transformative, what would that be?
Just one idea. It would be that blockchain, quote unquote blockchain, is not the important thing. It's the network of trustless individuals that makes everything work. And it's important to understand trustless. It doesn't mean you don't trust them. It means you don't have to trust them. I don't have to trust 2 + 2 = 4. 2 + 2 = 4. I don't care what you call it, right? You might start arguing about words, but if you have this many, you hold up, you know, you get that many together, you have this many, and that's trustless. And that's what really builds these networks up. It's not the technology in and of itself. And I guess the other point is, when you start talking about some of this stuff, you sort of hinted around this. We are now in a digital age, right? You have digital property, something we've never had to really confront before. So many things are digital, even your money now. Most people don't carry cash. Everything's this digital form. What sense does it make to not? You need a way to manage digital assets in a way like you would manage real world assets, but they move faster than real world assets. I can beam a digital asset from one side of the planet to the other in a matter of seconds, right? So how do you address ownership, digital ownership? And none of our traditional systems do that. And that is the big problem blockchain systems solve.
Okay. So, that is a great place to end it. that was a great answer.